Good afternoon. What I want to speak about today is Schar Shabbat, getting paid for work done on Shabbat and Yom Tov. There are, after all, I'm not talking about working in Intel over here on Har Chutzvin, which is at the moment a hot topic in Yerushalayim. Vast demonstrations every Shabbos because Intel wants to open up their factory for manufacturing computer chips on Shabbos. I'm not talking about getting paid for that kind of work, which is prohibited. I'm talking about getting paid for legitimate work on Shabbos and Yontif. After all, there are many things which one is legitimately allowed to do. If you are a physician or a nurse or a pharmacist, a chemist, or a physiotherapist, whatever, you're working in the hospital, of course it is permitted to engage in life-saving activities on Shabbos. And in treating non-life-threatening conditions in the hospital, and most people in the hospital because of life-threatening conditions, but some of them don't have life-threatening conditions, the work which the physician does, or the nurse, or all the people, might not be violations of Shabbos at all. Many times you can treat the patient without violating Shabbos at all, or if it's a life-threatening case, so even if violation of Shabbos is necessary, it's quite legitimate to work in this context. A restaurant in a hotel is open on Shabbos quite legitimately for its customers, and I hope that there's some kind of rabbinic supervision certifying not only the kashrus of the food in the restaurant, but also that there are no violations of Shabbos in the restaurant, in the hotel. The food is all correctly prepared before Shabbos, kept warm in the correct halachic ways, and the waiters will be instructed not to write down the orders of the customers, but to remember what the customers want and place the orders in the kitchen and fetch all the stuff correctly. Usually, the way it would work in a situation like this is the mashgiach, the rabbinical supervisor, will have prepared out of wood or plastic, something like this, little boxes, numbered boxes, each number corresponding to a room number in the hotel, and as customers order this or order that in the restaurant on Shabbos, so he put different color marbles in the different boxes. After Shabbos, he would come back and make a calculation about how much each customer has to be billed for the meals eaten on Shabbos, and then that's all quite legitimate, and there's no violation of Shabbos here. The waiters deserve to be paid for their work on Shabbos, just like the physicians, nurses, physiotherapists, pharmacists in the hospital. The mashgiach, of course, deserves to be paid for his work on Shabbos as well. And there are clearly many situations in which there is no violation of Shabbos. The only question arises whether it's okay to be paid for that work. For that labor, not labor in the sense of violating labor on Shabbos, but work that was done in accord with Shabbos regulations, babysitters, so forth and so on. In living memory, not so long ago, when I first came to Yerushalayim, there were restaurants under the supervision of the Rabbanut, under the supervision of the Rabbanut of Yerushalayim, on Rehov Yafo, that's the main drag down here, there were restaurants which were open on Shabbos. And they were quite correctly open on Shabbos. Customers who would want to eat there in the restaurant on Shabbos had to go before Shabbos, place their order at the cashier with the kupayit, and the cashier would then take the money before Shabbos, give a receipt to the customer. On Shabbos, you would come to the restaurant with your receipt in hand. When the waiter comes to your table, you'd give him the receipt, which is exactly what you already paid for, and then he would bring you the food which had been properly prepared before Shabbos, and there's no violation of Shabbos at all. Now, the waiters and the kitchen staff and so forth in this situation also deserve to be paid. and the question arises how to do it. The basic idea is as follows. The basic idea is havla'a, swallowing. Havla'a means swallowing. If the payment for work done on Shabbos is swallowed up in a global payment which covers not only Shabbos but also weekday activities, not only Yom Tov but also weekday activities, then all is well. There's no problem at all. For example, if the waiter works several shifts during the week and also on Shabbos, if the nurse in the hospital or the physician works several shifts during the week and also on Shabbos, at the end of the week, at the end of the month, whenever pay time comes, the payment of salary is not only for work on Shabbos, but also for work during the week, then that is fine and there's no problem at all. This leaves, of course, the problem of work which is done only on Shabbos. What about a waiter who works in the restaurant in the hotel only on Shabbos, or the babysitter who works only on Shabbos? This problem remains. In order to deal with this kind of problem, let us consider the following possibilities. If the waiter works in the restaurant, or the mashgiach works in the restaurant only on Shabbos, we have to ask, is there some weekday activity at all which is required here? That does the waiter or the mashgiach have to show up a little bit before Shabbos to get things ready and organized? Do they have to come after Shabbos to clean up afterwards? If there's some work being done before Shabbos or after Shabbos, then all is well. If the Baal Koreh, who is reading from the Torah on Shabbos morning, and all his work is being done on Shabbos morning only during Kriyas HaTorah, let us ask the question, did he have to prepare before Shabbos? Did he devote some time and energy to preparing for Kriyas HaTorah before Shabbos? If yes, then he's being paid for that as well. The example used by the poskim is the following example. Imagine, in the good old days, a midwife. You know midwife? That's halfway to being a wife, I think. These ladies who are halfway to being a wife, what happens if the labor and delivery is on Shabbos? Can they be paid? The answer is, in general, it's going to be okay, because in general, the midwife had to hold herself in konanut. The midwife had to hold herself in readiness during the week. She did not know when the labor was going to be. She did not know when the birth was going to be. It could have come during the week, and therefore during the week she had to hold herself in readiness. If she wanted to leave the village during the week, she'd have to make the effort to find a replacement so that if the labor would begin, that there'd be a midwife there to do it. Since she has to make an effort to hold herself in readiness during the week, that's part of what she is being paid for, and all is well.
Same for a moel.
Same for a moel. No. Not the same for a moel. Moel should not take any money at all for bris milah anytime. Not on Shabbos, not during the week at all. He's supposed to do it for free. So it's not the same. Yes.
We're learning the laws of
Borem.
So let's say there's a large lecture hall, full packed of students. I think I might think about that. I want to use the amount of a mosh pit. So a big, a Siddush conference in which you just have a fourth packed full of cousins, all dressed in their hats. And they're looking up for a rabbi. And one of them starts doing something terrible. Can the rabbi...
You want to call the sergeant at arms.
Shots,
you want to call the sergeant at arms and eject him.
Yeah, the question is, can you take the bad, not a shot, I'm saying, the bad, positive, out of the good?
No, I think what you have to do is remove all the good ones to another room and leave the bad one behind.
Is that real? You're being serious?
No. No. The rule is as follows. All of the examples of Borer in the Mishnah and in the Great Poskim, all the examples are examples of food. This raises the question whether the prohibition is limited only to food, or does it really apply to other things, and they happen to only be using the example of food. The first of the Great Poskim to propose the idea that the prohibition of Borer applies to objects which are not food was the Taz. We're talking about 16th century, early 17th century, which in the grand scale of things is very recent, right? 17th century is very recent as far as the history of halacha is concerned. Until that time, until the Taz, no one had written that the prohibition of Borer applies outside of food situations. Now, let's see if we can understand a little bit about the concepts which are underlying the idea here. Malacha on Shabbos, the 39 prohibited categories of work on Shabbos, writing, slaughtering animals, and so forth and so on, the 39 categories of prohibited work on Shabbos are all categories of labor which are creative. That is, something is created. You make something of positive value. You write something, you have writing. You slaughter an animal, you have a slaughtered animal. You have created, you've made something which is of value to you. That's true with all of the malacha on Shabbos. That's true with all of the prohibited labor on Shabbos, except for Borer. Borer is a little bit different than all the others, because in Borer, you've not made something which is of use. In Borer, you don't have a product of your labor. In Borer, you have two products of your labor, a pile of good stuff and a pile of bad stuff. You started with a mixture of good and bad mixed together, and you end up with two piles, good stuff and bad stuff. There are two products in Borer. Therefore, the post can teach us that if you can do Borer in a way that you will end up with only one product, you're not guilty of Borer. If you can do Borer, if you can separate the bad from the good or the good from the bad in a way that you have only one product and not two, then you're off the hook, you're innocent of violating the prohibition. The only practical way to do this is by eating one of the piles. If you separate the good from the bad, you take the good apples and leave the bad ones behind, and you eat the good apple, well, you don't have two products, do you? Because the one of them doesn't exist anymore. You've eaten it. And since you have only one product left, namely the bad, you're okay. Now, it would seem, would it not, that this is an idea which applies only to eating. But in point of fact, one can extend the idea conceptually in the following way. Imagine for a moment that I have a mixture on the plate of good food and bad food, nuts or berries, I don't care what it is on the plate, a mixture of good and bad. And imagine that I take a propane torch and I burn all of the bad things, I incinerate all the bad things, leaving only the good things. Now, it's clear that I'm guilty of burning on Shabbos, that's true, but am I also guilty of Borer? Am I going to have to bring one or two korbanot, one or two sacrifices to atone? If I only did one bad thing, namely burning, so I'll bring one sacrifice. If I'm also guilty of Borer, I have to bring two sacrifices when the Beis HaMikdash is rebuilt. Since I have incinerated the bad, leaving only the good behind, I don't have two products. I only have one product, and all is well. I'm not guilty of Borer in this case. I'm only guilty of burning. Now, the Taz was the first to teach us that the prohibition of borer applies to objects as well as food. Now, once he taught us that, he creates a bit of a conundrum. Imagine the following situations. If I have on the table or hanging on the hooks a lot of coats, many winter coats. It's winter, people have hung up their coats on the hooks or just thrown their coats on the table, and now I have a lot of winter coats. I have a mixture of winter coats, mine and theirs. Unfortunately, mine is somewhere in the middle of the pile or at the bottom of the pile. Mine is not at the top of the pile. Well, if mine is not at the top of the pile and borer is a prohibition here, how on earth can I remove the coats I don't want in order to get to the coat I do want? After all, borer, when it is permitted only to take the good that you want and leave the bad that you don't want behind. But here, since my coat is in the middle of the pile, not on the top of the pile, it should be prohibited to remove the coats I don't want in order to get to the coats that I do want. Similarly, if I have a pile of books, three books sitting on top of each other on the table, Bereishis, Shmos, and Bamidbar, three different volumes sitting on top of each other, and at the moment I want the middle one or the bottom one, well, removing what I don't want in order to get to what I do want should sounds like a violation of borer. And these examples can be multiplied, this conundrum could be broadened immensely, producing a huge number of problematic examples. How is it possible to live on Shabbos if the prohibition of borer is being extended also to kalim, to objects other than food? And after all, one of the elements necessary to permit borer on Shabbos is that you're going to eat the good thing that you like. Does that mean that if I can remove my coat from the top of the pile, I have to eat it? I mean, the problems created by the opinion of the Taz are immense. As long as borer is limited to food, I can figure out what the rules are and apply them. As soon as we broaden the prohibition of borer to objects other than food, we're left with a conundrum. I shall now solve that conundrum, and based on that solution, we'll be able to answer your specific question. First simple step is that if you use the item you want, you don't have to eat it, but if you use the item you want, according to the Aruch HaShulchan, and following the Aruch HaShulchan, all the great poskim, you're off the hook, and all is well. Therefore, if you have a shelf full of books, and you want to take the book that you want to use, and you use it, you're not guilty of borer, and you can put it back when you're done using it. Using, taking what you want, and using it in objects, is the same as taking the food you want and eating it. Incidentally, we should speak about the time interval between the act of eating, between the act of selecting and the eating. The time interval between the act of selecting and the using of the coat, the using of the object. There are different opinions regarding this. The mainstream opinion is that as long as you're selecting what you wish to use for the next meal, you're okay. How do we define for the next meal? The majority view of the poskim is that when davening is over, when shul is over Friday night, now we're called getting ready for the evening meal. It might be 15 minutes later, it might be an hour and a half later, but if davening is ended Friday night, now we're getting ready for the next meal, and selecting things for the next meal is okay. Similarly, in the morning, when davening is over in the morning, from that point on, you can get ready for the second meal, and for those who eat the Suda Shlishi, the same principle would apply after Mincha. That's the majority view. There is a more machmir position. The more machmir position is around 20 minutes. 20 minutes before you actually eat or use the object is the maximum time interval between the act of selecting and the use or consumption of what you've selected. As far as the poskim are concerned, I told you the majority view, but Rav Moshe Sternbuch, who today lives in Yerushalayim and is a member of the Bet Din of the Eidah Haredes in Mea Sharem, he used to be, until recently, he was a Rav in some place called Johannesburg, in some country called South Africa. I don't know exactly where it is. I could, you know, based on the name of the country, I could guess where it's located, but sometimes you're fooled by these things. He wrote what strikes me as being cogent and very forceful in its logic. He wrote that since it is the black maid who's going to be doing the work anyway, so one should take the machmir position and not let her prepare for the meal and more than 20 minutes before. I suppose that's a window into South African society. The next step in solving the conundrum is as follows. In order for there to be a prohibition of borer selecting one item from the mixture, there must first be a mixture. If you don't start out with a mixture, then there's no prohibition at all. What makes a mixture a mixture? I will now formulate the rule of the poskim, which was first formulated by the Aruch HaShulchan and subsequently accepted by all the great poskim. I'll formulate the rule. The rule is not easy to apply. It might require some thought, but the rule is as follows. There's a big difference between a large number of small things. A large number of small things together on the plate or together in the room, a large number of small things, that's a mixture, that's a ta'arovet, and selecting the bad from the good is prohibited. On the other hand, a small number of large things is not a mixture at all. If you have on the table an apple and a pear, that's not a mixture at all because it's a small number of large things. You can take the one you want, or you can take the one you don't want and put it away. There's no prohibition of bore at all. Now that leaves us with the problem of finding the border between a large number of small things where bore is prohibited, and a large number of small things where it's prohibited, as opposed to a small number of large things where it's permitted. What you have to do is look at the situation, and if your eye takes in all of the objects as a single mixture, then you know you have a prohibition. If, on the other hand, what your eye sees when you glance at it are a small number of large items, there's no prohibition of borer at all. For example, if you look at a plate of almonds and raisins, what you see is a plate of almonds and raisins. And therefore, if you want the almonds, you cannot separate the raisins. If you want the raisins, you cannot separate the almonds. There's a prohibition of borer. If, on the other hand, we're talking about a small number of large things, and you look at the bowl on the table, and what you see is not a bowl of fruit. What you see is an apple, a pear, and an orange. If what your eye takes in are the separate individual fruits, each of which is large, no prohibition of borer at all. Now, I admit that in many cases it might be difficult to categorize a specific situation one way or another. And if you find it difficult to categorize a situation one way or another, you might want to ask for rabbinic advice. Or if that's unavailable to you at the moment, you of course want to take the stricter position in order to avoid any possibility of a Torah violation here. Now, as long as we're talking about people, in the room, it is clear to me that we are not starting here with a ta'arovet. There is no mixture here. And since there is no mixture, because we're not talking about small items, therefore, no prohibition of borer at all. Every person is distinct, and since every person is distinct, and everyone looks different, everyone's face is different, what you see are individual people.
that's why I originally made the point of like
still, if you look at even a large number of people, what you see are individual faces, and therefore I think there should be no prohibition of borer at all in the specific case you mentioned.
My father's come to Israel a few months, and they wanted to go to the Baha'i Gardens in Haifa. Is it mutar to go there, or is it considered a place of the Baha'i?
Don't know. I don't know much about Baha'i. Are there idolatrous gods which are worshipped there? I really don't know. My understanding is, but again, I'm just speaking about what people have told me, and I've not looked into the matter myself. People have told me that there are no idols which are worshipped in the Baha'i temple in Haifa, and therefore it's not a place of Avodah Zarah. That's what I've been told, but this is all secondhand information. What you should do is, what they should do, if they're interested in clarifying the halacha, is find out the facts. If the facts are that they are worshipping idols there, then one cannot pay to enter the gardens. You have to pay? If it's for free, no problem at all. But if you have to pay to enter the gardens, and the fee that you pay is going to go towards the idolatrous worship, you know, buying sacrifices for the idols and so forth, then this is prohibited. If it's for free, then you're okay. Yeah, but this is not a church. This is just the gardens. The Gemara says quite specifically that to enter the garden next to an idolatrous temple is permitted if entrance is for free. If you have to pay, you cannot pay the fee, because that money you're paying for the sacrifices they're going to use.
Can you make a difference
between
the statues in the
garden? No, it doesn't matter. Okay. Yes.
You mentioned earlier that royals should not charge on Shabbos or during the week for services. Obviously, people do.
No, they don't.
Give money to.
Oh, yeah.
Royal. The kavanah should be that's basically a gift.
That's a gift. A gift. If you're happy with the services of the mohel, it's very nice to give him a gift. After all, there are two kinds of mohelim. I don't know if the word professional is apt here, because they don't get paid a salary. But if you're talking about someone who has devoted his life to milah, and he's doing 3, 4, or 5 a day, so he obviously cannot support himself and his family by any other job, because he doesn't have time, and therefore, if you're happy with his services, it surely makes sense to give him a gift in order to help him support himself and his family. If, on the other hand, you're talking about a mohel, which is more typical in Chutzlaritz, but exists here as well, someone who has a good job, but he happens also to have the skill, and he's trained as a mohel, and he happens to do it from time to time for friends, relatives, or neighbors, if you want to give him a gift, you can, but there's really no call to do so. Okay?
What if he's very rich?
Even the poor one, you're not obligated. A gift means, a gift is a gift. There's no such thing as being obligated to give a gift. It's nice to support the family of a mohel in order that he will be free to provide his services to the community. That's very nice to do, but the customer, that is the parents of the baby, are not obligated to do so.
Could you help us out a little bit with the laws of the fruits or fruit vegetables that are strong, clarifying the issues involved?
The different opinions. All the produce of the land, everyone agrees that all the produce of the land must have trumot and maaserot separated from the fruits and vegetables, the grains. All the produce of the land is prohibited until the tithes, the trumot and maaserot, are correctly separated, and then the produce of the land becomes permitted. If you buy fruits, vegetables, and grains, any produce of the land, in a shop, a greengrocer, a supermarket, where there is a valid rabbinic certificate certifying that the mitzvah has been done correctly, then you have no problem at all. If you go over here to Machane Yehuda, the open market, the shuk, most of the stalls have a certificate of the rabbanut certifying that the mitzvah has been done, And for those who rely in general upon the Rabbanut, that should be quite sufficient. Some of the stalls, a fairly small number, have Mahadrin certificates from the various Mahadrin Hechsherim, and those who wish to follow Mahadrin standards will look for those stalls that have the Mahadrin. Some stalls in Machane Yehuda have no rabbinic supervision at all, no kind of certificate at all. And if you buy from them, there's no way to know whether the mitzvah has been done at all. Maybe the mitzvah has been done on the wholesale level, who knows, but there's no way to know. Therefore, if you buy from a shop which has no certificate at all, when you get the fruits and vegetables home, you will want to do the mitzvah yourself without pronouncing a bracha, because maybe the mitzvah is already done and you're not accomplishing anything. If you buy from a shop which has an ordinary rabbinut certificate, and you wish Mahadrin standards, then you'll do the same thing. You'll do the mitzvah of separating Trumot and Maserot yourself without a bracha, because maybe the mitzvah has been correctly done. And if you buy from a place with a Mahadrin Heksher, then you're home free. You can just take those things and do it yourself. In addition to Trumot and Maserot, there are other issues regarding produce of the land. For example, Chadash. Chadash is a prohibition prohibiting every grain crop, wheat, every grain crop, until the second day of Pesach. Therefore, every grain crop, the grains must be set aside in storage until the second day of Pesach, and then they become permitted. Now, that's not a big problem in Israel, because Israel does not grow much grain. There's a small amount of wheat which is grown in Israel in the area around Beersheba, but almost all of it, perhaps all of it, goes into the baking of shmura matzah on Pesach, and is therefore under rigorous rabbinic control, and that wheat never ends up in the general market. Almost all the wheat, surely all the commercial wheat in Israel, comes from the United States, and is all under the supervision of the Eda Charedis in Mea Sharim. They guarantee that it's not Chadash, it's not from the current crop, it's from last year's crop, and Pesach has already passed. Occasionally, shipments of wheat from the United States are indeed Chadash. When this happens, the Eda Charedis makes arrangements for that shipment to be diverted to another country, and instead a different shipment, which is indeed from the previous year's crop, ends up in Israel. So that's in general not a problem. Orla is more commonly a problem. Fruit from a fruit tree, not vegetables, not grains, but fruit from a fruit tree, for the first 3 years that it grows, all the fruit produced by the fruit tree in the first 3 years is prohibited. In the fourth year, in the fourth year of growth, fruit produced by the tree is still prohibited, but can be redeemed through a redemption procedure, and then becomes permitted. In earlier years, in earlier generations, this was rarely a problem, because most trees produce very little fruit in the first 3-4 years of growth, and therefore this was never a commercial problem. It just was not worth harvesting the fruit from trees in the first, second, third year of growth. It just wasn't enough to make it worth harvesting and sending to market. In earlier generations, this was a problem for people who had fruit trees in their own personal private garden. In the second year, you might get one or two apples. In the third year, you might get a dozen apples. In private gardens, this was a problem. Nowadays, with modern agricultural techniques, commercial crops can be produced in the second year of growth, and indeed there are examples of commercial crops being produced even in the first year of growth. Modern agriculture has reached that state where this is possible, and therefore the amount of orla on the market has increased greatly in recent years, and therefore, in order to avoid orla, apples or any other fruit from the first 3 years of growth, you should do one of the following two things. Either buy your fruits from a shop which has rabbinic supervision, and indeed, even the rabbanut supervision says on the certificate, if you go here to Machane Yehuda and you go to most of the stalls which have ordinary rabbanut supervision, not Mahadran, it says on the certificate, all the fruits in this shop are okay, except for, and then it lists a few fruits which at the moment have commercial crops available from the first 3 years. If you go, of course, into a Mahadran shop, then these fruits will not be offered for sale at all, and you don't have to even consider. So if you're buying in a shop with a valid certificate, check the certificate carefully. Either it's Mahadran, and all the fruits in the store are free of orla, or it's regular rabbanut, and it will list the fruits which are problematic, and you should, of course, avoid those. If you're in a place where you don't have the rabbanut of Yerushalayim certificate, or you don't have a Mahadran certificate, the only simple way to know which fruits are problematic at any given point in the season is to call up the Beit Midrash Gavoa Lachaklaut, which is located at the very beginning of Har Nof, just as you enter Har Nof. They have a telephone number in the directory, Beit Midrash Gavoa Lachaklaut. You call them up, the secretary which answers, you can ask her for a list of the problematic fruits at the moment which are in the market, and it varies from season to season. Or if you have a specific fruit in mind, you can just ask her, and she'll read off from the list for you what's okay and what isn't. I doubt it.
Yiddish.
If you're following the rabbinic standards, you have no problem at all, because most of the stalls are covered by that. If you want Mahadran standard, then if you want, I can give you a list of the Mahadran names which are legit. There are quite a number of dicey ones, dodgy ones, how do you say in English? Highly suspicious ones, which should be avoided. I can give you a list of the good ones. Shvius is no longer a problem as far as fresh fruits and vegetables are concerned. After all, we're now 3 years since the Shemitah year, and therefore we no longer have any fresh fruits or vegetables from the Shemitah year. On the other hand, tinned, canned, preserved fruits and vegetables might indeed be from the Shemitah year. The only way to deal with this is to see that there's a Mahadran Hechsher on the tin, on the can, on the preserved fruits or vegetables, then you're okay. Otherwise, you can check the production date. If the production date is given in ordinary Hebrew or ordinary English, then you're okay. Often it's given in a code, which is, like you have to find someone who understands the code. But usually the production date is given in ordinary Hebrew or ordinary English date, and if it comes from the Shemitah, you're in trouble. If it isn't, it's okay.
You shouldn't have that.
If it comes from the Shemitah year, it's prohibited. Yes.
On Shabbos, sometimes we have a checkpoint.
Yes.
And we're there for a long time.
Yes.
Some people in my unit, they don't eat food from afar.
Yes. Which pluga are you in? Okay. Yeah.
So are they allowed? I said they're allowed to eat food.
It's a problem. The,
yeah,
it's probably before I turn to this, I'll turn to this in a moment. Let me just point out that all of the problems of fruits and vegetables grown in Israel, which I have mentioned, apply equally to Israel-grown fruits and vegetables which are sold abroad. If you buy an Israeli avocado in New York.
Even if it's owned by
Israel. Doesn't matter if you buy an avocado or a tomato which grew in Israel. This is a machlokas, but there's really no way to know where it grew. By the time it gets to New York, there's no way to know where it grew. And therefore, if you want to buy an Israeli avocado, tomato, whatever it is, in New York, in London, anywhere in the world, and Israel markets its agricultural produce all over the world, what you have to do is ask a local rav, wherever you are, New York, London, wherever it is, ask him whether these problems, the problems of Trumot and Maserot, have been handled and taken care of. A local rav should be able to inform you that either it's okay on this wholesale level, everything has been taken care of, and therefore you can buy it on the retail level, or perhaps the problems have not been taken care of, in which case you have to separate Trumot and Maserot yourself without a bracha. How do you do it? It's a fairly complicated procedure. What you should do is equip yourself with a siddur, which has a step-by-step, the procedure, what to do. Unfortunately, it's not in the Chabad siddur. Right, the Chabad siddur originates from Chutz La'aretz, but siddurim, which originate from Eretz Yisrael, Art Scroll has an Israeli edition of their siddur. Any Israeli siddur has a section in it which goes step by step, telling you the procedure of separating Trumot and Maserot. Study it, make sure you understand everything, and then just go one step after another and do what it says in the siddur, and you'll be okay. Again, if you buy any familiar. It's a little bit of a complicated procedure, but if you want to do it, that's fine. Well, you do not say the bracha if it's possible that the mitzvah has already been done. After all, it's possible that the fruits come from a from moshav, where they didn't let the fruits leave the moshav without doing the mitzvah. It's possible that it was done on the wholesale level. As long as it's possible the mitzvah was done, so you will do the mitzvah without a bracha. If you get the fruits or vegetables straight from the field, like my dear cousin who comes to visit occasionally from the kibbutz, always bringing a big crate of whatever is fresh at the moment, he knows that I would like to do the mitzvah myself occasionally. He goes out, brings the stuff straight from the field, and so I know the mitzvah has not been done, so I do the mitzvah with a bracha. What? So if you're uncertain, you do the mitzvah but without a bracha. I have to get to the Shabbos question. What? You only say the bracha if you're certain that the mitzvah has not been done. Well, any good sitter will have it. Asher kichanu mitzvotav v'tzivanu lahafrish trumot u'maserot. But any good sitter will have the bracha at the correct place. Should we turn to the Shabbos question? Yeah. We have a Shabbos question pending here. First of all, there are a number of ways to go if you wish to serve in the Israeli army. The food supplied by the Israeli army is all under hechsher. The food supplied by the Israeli army all has some kind of rabbinic hechsher to it, and that's fine. Those who wish to serve in the Israeli army in a strictly mahadran environment have the option of signing up for the Nahal Haredi. The Nahal Haredi is a branch of the army which is mahadran. The food served is not only with the level of supervision of the Rabbanut, but all the food served is strictly mahadran. And as far as Shabbos is concerned, Shabbos observance in the Nahal Haredi is on a much stricter standard than in the army in general. The Nahal Haredi has many rules and regulations in order to guarantee the high level of Torah observance. For example, on the military bases of the Nahal Haredi, no women are allowed at all. Whereas in general in the army, one finds oneself in problems of men and women together in situations which are not as tzniistic not as modest as they can be. In the Nachal Haredi, no women at all. Indeed, on the first day that one goes into the army, all Israeli soldiers, on the first day that they go into the army, have to show up at a place where you're taken into the army in Tel HaShomer in Tel Aviv, where there's a whole procedure. You go through medical procedures, and you're issued your equipment and so forth. And so it's all procedure to be inducted into the army. If you sign up for the Nachal Haredi, the day that you go to Tel HaShomer in order to be inducted, all of the soldiers will be male soldiers doing the medical tests and issuing your equipment and so forth and so on. The female soldiers are not working on the day that the Nachal Haredi has their induction into the army. In addition, Nachal Haredi is careful to always leave time for tefillot and so forth and so on. So if what you want is a Mahadran level, that's okay. Now, in the Nachal Haredi, therefore, the rule is that combat soldiers who are manning machsomim, what do they call machsom in English? Checkpoints, when they have their food brought to them on Shabbos, it's cold. It's not cooked food. In order to avoid this problem. In the Nachal Haredi, all of the drivers on Shabbos are Druzim. In the Nachal Haredi, all the drivers on Shabbos are Druzim. But the Nachal Haredi also has to go out on patrol on Shabbos and also has to man the checkpoints and do all the things that combat soldiers do. But to get to the wherever they have to go on Shabbos, which is of course outside of their base, outside of the camp, a non-Jewish driver will drive them. And on the Nachal Haredi, when you get to the checkpoint, every checkpoint has of course a properly constructed eruv around it, so there's no problem in carrying your weapon or carrying anything else that you have to carry at the checkpoint. The patrol is scheduled in a way that when it's time for lunch, when it's time for a meal, they will be at a checkpoint where the food has been brought by a Druze driver. And on Shabbos, of course, they have also the grape juice and so forth in the Kiddush, and they'll eat at the checkpoint and then continue their patrol. In the Nachal Haredi, Nachal Haredi deals extensively with ma'atzarim, with arrests of suspected Arab terrorists have to be arrested in the villages. This is an activity which the Nachal Haredi does a lot, but they don't do it on Shabbos. On Shabbos, the terrorists know they're not going to be arrested if they're in the territory of the Nachal Haredi. Shall I give you a trivial example which will indicate to you the way it works? If you are on guard duty, among the things you have to do on guard duty is you have to climb up into the tower and you have to watch. That's what guard duty is. You sit there watching, and someone has to do it. And if it has to be done on Shabbos, also. If you don't have guards, then you're really in trouble. You can be attacked. So the guard duty has to be done on Shabbos. You have to have someone up there watching. And the soldiers who are on duty for at the top of the towers are given by the army night vision binoculars, so they can watch at night. And the night vision binoculars allows them to see in the dark what's going on, and they're protecting the base or protecting whatever it is they're protecting up there. Now, the following occurred just recently. I was told by a soldier in the army. The night vision binoculars require batteries. Without batteries, they don't work. Because there's an electronic system which magnifies the incoming light, but a battery has to operate the whole system. In the Nachal Haredi, one thing you have to know about the Israeli army Believe it or not, the Israeli army is not the most perfectly organized organization in the world. They sometimes not perfectly organized. And as a result of not always being perfectly organized, they didn't have batteries. The batteries ran out, and on Tuesday, there simply were no batteries to power the night vision binoculars, and the soldiers had to do the best they could without the battery operated night vision binoculars. That was true on Tuesday night, it was true on Wednesday night, it was true on Thursday night. On Friday, a new shipment of batteries arrives in the base. Now this raises a very interesting question. Is it really an act of pikuach nefesh? Is it really a life-saving procedure to use the night vision binoculars? If so, it's correct to use the battery-driven night vision binoculars on Leil Shabbos on Friday night also. But if that's true, then the army was guilty of severe negligence. The army was guilty of a severe violation in not supplying the soldiers with the batteries which they needed on Tuesday night, Wednesday night, and Thursday night. If it's really not so important, and therefore there was really not such a rush to supply the batteries, well, apparently it's not necessary for a life-saving procedure. And some decision has to be made on this issue. In the Nahal Haredi, you can count on them to take a strict position which does not adversely affect any security issues. Why is all this interesting? Bottom line, if you don't want to worry about any halakhic problems, if you don't want to have questions about what is permitted and what is not permitted on Shabbos, if you don't want to have questions about what is okay and not okay in Kashrus, if you don't want to have problems about what is okay or not okay in the army in terms of tzniyas, modesty with men and women working together, if you just don't want to have any problems, if you want everything to go smooth in a way which is carefully regulated, join the Nahal Haredi. Now, if you're not in the Nahal Haredi, then a number of halakha questions are going to arise in the course of your service, and what you're going to want to do is be in contact with the local Rav. Every pluga, every division of the army has its own Rav, who'll be able to advise you about what's okay and what's not okay. As far as this specific question is concerned, if the food was heated on Shabbat in a prohibited way, if that's what happened, then the food is indeed prohibited until such time as it cools off and one no longer benefits from the fact that it was heated. If, on the other hand, the food was prepared in a halachically correct way, it was cooked before Shabbos and kept hot in a correct way, then it's permitted and no problem at all. The biggest problem arises not in the bases. In the bases, which are large groups of soldiers, things are regulated very well. But as soon as a small group of soldiers gets sent out to do avtacha, to do the security around some little moshav, some little group somewhere, they have their own place to sleep on the moshav. They have their own utensils to cook with, and all of a sudden there's no longer any rabbinic supervision on the kashrus or anything else, and you have to figure out yourself whether it's okay. Of course, when the ordinary combat soldiers are sent out to do security around some settlement, who knows where, if it's the Nahal Haredi which is sent, then the soldiers arrive typically on a Thursday morning, is usually when the change of units takes place. The new soldiers arrive on a Thursday morning, and half an hour later arrives the truck where the Nahal Haredi has their own food, their own utensils, and all their own stuff is brought, and that's what they use, and they know they're free of any problems. Okay, are there other issues? Yes.
Other question on riding on a cruise on Shabbos?
A cruise?
Um,
uh, uh, in, In the good old days, not so long ago, Tzim, the Israeli shipping line, also had passenger ships. They no longer have passenger ships, now it's only shipping. But back when they had passenger ships, the Lubavitcher Rebbe was very unhappy with the fact that the ships went on Shabbos as well. He thought the ships should be, he thought the engines should be turned off, and there should be no violation of Shabbos. The ship should drift on Shabbos, and then after Shabbos, they should turn on the motors again and get back on course. And therefore, the Rebbe tried, was largely successful as well, in developing a boycott. He wanted Torah observant Jews not to travel on the Tzim passenger lines because the boats were operated by Jews and they were violating Shabbos, not only in the engine room, but the electrical system of the ship, the plumbing system, was all operated on Shabbos, a huge number of violations of Shabbos. While the Rebbe was drumming up support for this boycott, among the people he turned to for support was Rav Moshe Feinstein, the author of Igus Moshe, the great posek in New York. And the Rebbe sent Rav Moshe a shaila: is it not prohibited, according to halacha, is it not prohibited to go on these cruises where the Jewish crew members are going to be violating Shabbos? Rav Moshe Feinstein responded in a published tshuva in the Igus Moshe, in which his conclusion is, there's absolutely no prohibition at all, and it's entirely permitted. And many people were following the opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein as well. As far as today is concerned, where we no longer have Jewish cruise boats, it's all non-Jewish boats, as far as this is concerned, as long as the passenger is not violating Shabbos, it doesn't matter that the crew is violating Shabbos. They're non-Jewish. They are violating Shabbos. It's not called a violation of Shabbos if a non-Jew does it. They're doing it for their own purposes because it's their job to steer the boat. It's their job to make sure the electrical system and the plumbing system and everything works correctly. The problem is that on many modern cruise boats, the bathrooms in individual rooms are all controlled electronically. That is, there's a proximity sensor, and after you stand up from the toilet, an electronic proximity sensor automatically flushes the toilet. Since it's prohibited on Shabbos to operate these electronic devices, a ship like that is prohibited because you, the passenger, will be violating Shabbos. If, on the other hand, you're on an older boat, which the passenger is not violating Shabbos, it's only the staff, then you're okay. Yes. A number of reasons. First, he was of the opinion that letting the ship drift freely on Shabbos is potentially a life-threatening situation, and that the reason the motors are left going and controlled is in order to keep the ship properly righted, and therefore there is an element of pikuach nefesh here, and therefore they're permitted to do that. That's what he held. Okay. It's okay. According to all of the great posts, with one exception that I'll mention in a moment, it is permitted to put yourself in a situation where you know you will have to violate Shabbos. For example, it is permitted in the old days, it is permitted to join a caravan going from Yerushalayim to Damascus, even though it's going to take a whole week, a week and a half, to get from here to Damascus with the camels in the caravan, and you know that Shabbos is going to occur during your trip, and if you would stay behind, the caravan's going to keep going, they're all goyim, they're going to keep going, and if you would stay behind, you would be in a life-threatening situation, because the bandits and the thieves will come and kill you and steal all your property. The reason you are in a caravan is in order to protect yourself against thieves who will kill you and steal your merchandise. You're allowed to begin the caravan even though you know that a few days later is going to be Shabbos, and you're going to be in a life-threatening situation, and you're going to have to violate Shabbos in order to save your life. Similarly, all the great poskim, with one exception that I'm about to mention, all the great poskim hold it is permitted to undergo non-emergency surgery on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, even though you know that as a result of the surgery, you are going to be in a life-threatening situation on Shabbos, and it's going to be necessary to violate Shabbos. The only one of the great poskim who rejects this idea was Rav Hanan Wasserman, Rosh Yeshiva from Europe before the Shoah. He was killed by the Nazis, but in his writings, he's the only one of the great poskim who holds it's prohibited to join a caravan or have surgery or do anything in this manner where you know you're going to have to violate Shabbos. Since he's the only one of the great poskim who's machmir, so obviously the mainstream is lenient. Given a choice, one should not begin an ocean voyage on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday. The reason is, have you ever been on an ocean voyage? I have been, and if you ever go on an ocean voyage, you will discover that most of the passengers are horribly sick at the beginning of the voyage, a lot of vomiting at the beginning of the voyage, and then after a few days you feel fine. Because of Oneg Shabbos, because we're supposed to enjoy Shabbos, so Chazal insists that ocean voyages be started at the beginning of the week, Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, so that by the time Shabbos comes, you will have your sea legs and you will not be vomiting anymore. And therefore, if you want to have non-urgent surgery performed, and it would be better if you can schedule the surgery, it would definitely be preferable to schedule the surgery at the beginning of the week so that by the time Shabbos comes, you will feel better. However, if the date that is available for you, for the surgeon that you prefer, happens to be at the end of the week, this is not a reason to postpone the surgery. Okay?
Therefore, the same thing would be with the ship, if the other option to travel to Israel with the ship.
No, the ship is an Isur Derabbanan, which is mentioned explicitly in the Gemara. Surgery is not something they spoke about. It's only similar to what they spoke about, and therefore there is no prohibition of surgery, even though you'll feel bad on Shabbos. It's just a good idea to schedule it earlier in the week. It's not required.
I'm saying, so therefore, any time you have another option, so just you're still traveling to Israel, the Israeli ship. If there was any other country that was doing it, weren't Israeli, any other way of doing it, that would seem to be forbidden to take this Israeli ship.
According to the opinion of Rabbi Hanan Wasserman, but he's the only one who's machmir, all the other posts can hold, there's no problem at all.
Even if there's another option without having to violate Shabbos at all?
Correct. There's no prohibition at all to put yourself in a situation where you know you will have to violate Shabbos. But if you know that the trip is going to go over Shabbos anyway, so it doesn't apply, does it? But you're correct. Of course it's wise to travel early in order to avoid any possibility of violation. Of course it's wise if you can plan your life in a way that you'll be able to keep Shabbos properly. Of course that's nice. Yeah, but there's a difference between commendable and required. Of course it's commendable to schedule your life in a way that you'll be able to observe Shabbos properly. But that's not exactly required. Okay, we have time for one more question, perhaps? Any final questions? Yes. Yeah, I think so. I think so. If DNA if part of a DNA sequence from a treif animal is put into a plant, does that make the plant prohibited? No. The plant is still a plant, and therefore permitted as it is. There's a lot to be concerned about in genetic engineering. There's a lot to be concerned about. We don't know what all the ramifications might be, and therefore, of course, it deserves a lot of care. But that's not a halakhic issue. That's just a simple safety issue, which everyone should be concerned about. Rather like nanotechnology, which in my opinion is being vastly, vastly overused in contemporary society, where no one knows what the ramifications might be as far as human health or the environment. No one knows what the ramifications of nanotechnology might be, and a huge number of nanoparticles are being manufactured and released into the environment, and no one has the slightest idea what this is going to do. So, we've reached the end of our shiur today. I wish you all good Shabbos, and we'll see you next time.